broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Meredith has been advised not to pay more than 10,000 Rwandan francs for a full bolt of cloth. Moving through the stalls of the market, she admires the bright colors, deep blues, purples, and black embossed with neon or metallic ink in garish patterns of trees, flowers, or eucalyptus leaves. Tight patterns of fish, stones, feathers, or geometric shapes in various shades and tints. Meredith likes a raindrop pattern in blue. But the saleswoman wants 12,000 Rwandan francs. The next stall has the same pattern in a lilac for 10,000. But Meredith doesn't like the color or the way the vendor pushes more bolts at her. In a shop that straddles the corner, she buys a remnant of the fish pattern in blue and yellow for the children's play table in her office at home. Circling to the far side, she finds an elegant piece of green jungle background, emblazoned with a gold bird, part kiwi, part hummingbird, but the piece is only 8 meters. The golden seal, torn. She buys it anyway. With time running out, Meredith finds a sealed bolt that is blue and buttercream yellow in a pattern like river stones and pays 12,000 because she likes the soft-spoken saleswoman with a round-cheeked baby tied to her back. The woman understands neither French nor English and barters silently by typing numbers into Meredith's cell phone. Sherry Hoffman, in her short story, The Audrey Hepburn, published in Volume 9 of the Delmarva Review. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. There are thousands of markets around the world like the one in Butare, Rwanda, described by Sherry Hoffman in her short story. In many communities in the developing world, they are unregulated, that is, part of the informal economy. They offer a place to meet, a place to buy, a place to sell, a chance to work. But mostly they offer opportunity, the chance to share in the economic life of the community. My guest today is Neil Jackson, a photojournalist and resident of Maryland's Eastern Shore, who has recently published a book of portraits of public marketplace vendors from around the world. The book is called Market: The Sellers, the Stuff, the Soul, Portraits of the World's Meeting Place. Neil, you're a photographer, a consultant, an educator, and I understand you taught the business of photojournalism in the International Center of Photography in New York and around the world in the Foundry Photojournalism Workshop. You were also chairman of the board of the prestigious Seven Photo Agency for 5 years. But Neil, you were also the chief legal officer for National Public Radio from 1996 to 2008. So, okay, tell me, how does one go from being the chief attorney for NPR to being an international photojournalist. I believe you said early there was something about a cocktail party in here.
Well, that's how the book started. But the transition from being the chief legal officer of NPR to being a working photojournalist occurred in a little more long-term basis. I had always been a serious photographer ever since college, and I had worked harder sometimes and less hard other times, depending upon family demands, depending upon work demands and the like. But when I was at NPR, it was in an era when NPR had never done any visual journalism. And they began with their website to have a need for visual journalism. The person in charge of that came to me one day and said, look, how do we make this happen? How do we make visual journalism be a part of the NPR website? This would have been in the late last century, 98, 99, 2000. I said, well, you need a picture editor. He said, okay. I said, that's a start. So how do I get one? He said, well, or I said, let's, you need to hire one. What do I do to hire one? I said, you got to have a job description. He said, okay, how do I get a job description? I said, well, you make one up. And he said, well, listen, it turns out this editor had been with the Wall Street Journal in the era when the Wall Street Journal had no photos. It had only pen and ink drawings. So he didn't have any exposure from that era. But to make a long story short, I ended up drafting the job description when he put out a call for people who had who wanted to take the job. And as it always at NPR, there were hundreds who applied, all of whom were qualified. He arrived in my office with this stack of resumes, and I said, hey, good, congratulations. You know, you've gotten a lot. He says, but I don't know how to select them. I said, well, I'll help you. To try to cut to the chase here, I did. I gave him 10 back. He interviewed, selected someone. Somehow that made me into a guru within NPR of visual journalism, at least for a while, until the people that were ultimately hired to run that element of the website were involved. And so in the process of being, you know, the go-to person there for a limited period, I began to make contacts within the industry. And I then went to a number of gatherings, and I soon was recognized as a person in photojournalism. And one thing led to another. I decided it was an itch that I had to scratch. And so I decided in 2008 to leave NPR and become a photojournalist. And bingo, bingo. Suddenly there were offers from various places to help out. And so I just responded to them. So that's a long answer to your question, but it just was a natural evolution for me.
Neil, when you started out, left NPR and started out as a photojournalist, how did you market yourself? How did you find clients?
Well, to some extent, I wasn't. Fortunately, I didn't have to live on my photojournalism, so I didn't have to market myself heavily. But because of this connection that I had had with the world of photojournalism, I had plenty of offers for people. And the biggest area that I was working in was consulting and teaching in the business of photojournalism. Soon after I left NPR, I was hired on or was appointed the chairman of the board of the 7 Photo Agency. And soon after that, I also was asked to teach at the Foundry Photojournalism Workshop, which is a really important seminar for photojournalists that are evolving in various parts of the world. And so between that and contacts that I had with non-governmental organizations, with a magazine, with a few other entities, There frankly was plenty to do. I didn't want to spend 8 hours a day doing this, but as it turned out, for periods of time, I would spend 8 hours a day doing this. So it was, it just evolved.
Well, what is the Seven Photo Agency? For those of us who are not familiar with the world of photojournalism, what are we talking about here?
Seven is a collective, if you will, of photographers who came together in 2001 to create an agency of elite photographers. Most of these people had been involved in reporting on the war in Yugoslavia and had known one another from that era and were specialists in covering conflict journalism. And so they decided to create an entity. And so they went off to an international conference in the beginning of September 2001 and announced the creation. A few days later, 9/11 occurred. And so that was the beginning of a huge period of conflict. It's lots of work for them. And they continue today. They're just excellent photographers, much in the nature of the famous Magnum agency, except that they own the agency themselves and operate it themselves and keep it small and only bring in the very best photographers. It's bigger now. It started out, it was called Seven because only seven people started it. But that's... my job was to be the chairman of the board and help them manage that, which has been a tricky period because photojournalism has been under siege in a way economically.
So you were on the business side.
For them, I was on the business side. I was not a photographer. I've never reached the level of work quality that they produce. Their work is just extraordinary, every one of them.
Well, you've got a beautiful book. Here, market, the sellers, the stuff, the soul. For our listening audience, tell us a little bit about your book. Describe your book. It's a very unique and interesting approach to photographing markets and other venues around the world, I would think.
Well, how the gist of it is that it started out of a Washington, D.C. cocktail party conversation.
No, well, that was the cocktail party that I mentioned earlier.
That's right. And it started out of that. Someone who worked for one of the multilateral organizations like the World Bank or Inter-American Development Bank was holding forth, as I recall, and they said that a very large percentage of the world's household commerce, and that by that I think they meant food, clothing, pots and pans, cleaning materials, etc. A large percentage of that moves through public markets. And I think the number was over 50%. But I can't remember, and I haven't been able to find verification of that. But I thought, that's ridiculous. That couldn't be that much. But then I thought more about it, and I realized that in places like Asia, Africa, South America, and the like, they don't have a Walmart, or they don't have a Carrefour or a big marketplace, a Target, in all these. And so they have to find the things that they use to live with somewhere. And so that is generally the public market. They go to the public market to get food, to get clothing, to get the range of things, animals, livestock. And so I decided this is an interesting thing. How do we tell this story? Everybody's been to markets somewhere, even domestic markets, and they're always full of color and food and other materials. But, they're full of sort of distracting images. You take a picture of a vendor selling vegetables, and it's great, but then how do you convey the sense of the market? So I concluded that there were four elements to a market. One, the place to the customers, three, the goods, and four, the vendors. And of those four items, the most visually compelling would be the vendors and their goods, with the result that I said, well, if I'm going to tell a story of markets, why don't I do it through vendors and their goods? And so that's how the project began. And there were a number of other elements that evolved out of it, but that's the beginning of the project.
Well, describe your book to us, so our listening audience will get a sense of this piece of photojournalism that I'm looking at particularly. It's difficult to do a photo book on the radio. So give us a sense of what you've got here.
Well, Hal, what we have here is a couple of hundred pages of people who are a part of the public market world in their respective area. And they are portraits, meaning they are people's, they are photographs of the peoples themselves, and they're taken with their goods in front of a white backdrop. And so we have photos in here that range from men selling pots in Colombia to women selling breakfast buns in Senegal to men selling chickens to I forget where, but then we have people who are selling camels, men selling camels in the nation of Qatar. The individuals are each photographed with in front of the backdrop, and the backdrop was carried with us. It's a 3 meter by 3 meter backdrop, or 3 meter by 6 meter, I should say, backdrop that sat on a particular portable screen, and we were able to therefore isolate individuals from all of the other distractive elements in the area. The photos are show the goods, and hopefully show a bit of the personality and spirit of the vendors.
Well, if I can add to your description, what we don't have. We don't have any group shots, particularly. There may be a couple with goods in the market, but basically, you set up your white background and placed a vendor in that environment with some of their goods, and photograph them in that kind of portraiture nature.
That's right. That's correct. That's how it worked. The vendors had to be recruited, which wasn't easy, not because they were reluctant, but just because they were busy. This was a busy time for them, and very often they had no backups in their stalls, and so they had to dash over to the pop-up studio we had there and dash back. And so we had anywhere from maybe 60 to 120 seconds to catch a number of images, which we could use to portray them. And so it was tricky. It was tricky. But the interesting thing was we had considerable cooperation from them. The biggest problem were physical issues, trying to get a place to set up. And we set up in the market. We did not use any lights. We used natural light for everything. And we had to comply with whatever the structure was of the market. Sometimes we had to set it up and set the pop-up studio in a stall which was not full that day. And sometimes we had to set it up in behind the toilets or behind the any sort of office that might be there. But it was tricky. That was part of the challenge of getting into each market.
So, yes, you're a distraction yourself in the sense of bringing in your photographic equipment and this portable studio that you carried with you. But let me ask you this, Neil, if it's not too intrusive at this point. You photographed in every continent except two, I understand. So I can just...
One of them, Antarctica, doesn't have any markets.
Well, okay.
You're right?
No.
That's right. We covered it. We covered the world, pretty much.
Exactly. So what I wanted to ask you is, how did you finance this venture? I mean, I've traveled internationally before for work, and I understand the expense involved in traveling around the world and other things that are involved. But how did you finance this activity? Did you get a grant? Did you are you a member of the 0.0% in the world here?
No, I am not in that. While I was a lawyer for a number of years, the last part of my career was spent in public radio salaries, which are considerably less. Even though I was sort of top of the heap there, it was much less. No, it was done as tack-ons to other work that I had. For example, if I had a teaching gig in Africa, they would pay my way to and from Africa and my accommodations while I was teaching. I would then, when I was there, I would bring the backdrop along and I would make the arrangements, get a fixer, a person to help us take the photographs, and would... when I wasn't teaching or when there was time, we would go out and to a market or two and take images. Taking the example of Africa, for example, we were in Cape Town, and I looked to see what it costs to go to some other African locations. Well, Ethiopian Air, while it may have gotten a lot of bad press recently, is a very efficient and very good airline, which meets the needs of a lot of people in Africa. So I found for not too much more money, I could fly out on the way back to Washington. I could fly out of Cape Town to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia and to Senegal, Dakar, Senegal, and have an opportunity. The only opportunity or the only additional cost was some accommodations, which I had to buy in Addis and in Dakar. So the long and short of it is this was tacked on. I could never afford it. There were only a couple of instances when I think I actually paid the way. One was to go to see a friend in South America that we had planned to go, my wife and I had planned to go see. And the other was to see a dear friend in India who was, and so when we got there, he took us on a great tour and some wonderful images came out of the time with him. So it all worked out. You know, it was not a major economic burden.
So you traveled by yourself, Neil, or did you have someone along with you to help you transport this portable studio and your photography equipment?
Well, I had someone along with me in many instances. My wife decided she would go along, and she basically financed some of her own trips on this. But in instances when she didn't know, it was me and the pop-up studio. And then when I got to the location, I would cover. I would meet up with our fixer that we had hired in advance, and the fixer and I would would proceed to do the project for the next day or two.
Well, you've got the cover of your book is a woman in a bright colored outfit and a pot on top of her head, and clearly it's a striking photograph. And a lot the photographs in the book are generally of this nature. She's standing in front of the white background that you have. But tell us a little bit about this photograph.
Well, that's kind of an interesting one because this was actually, I think, the last photograph we took in the five-year project. There's a photograph in the book of a young woman, a young African woman, Senegalese woman, who's carrying a pan that had biscuits in it, or breakfast biscuits. We saw her working throughout. She's a very attractive young woman, and we saw her working the market, and she was, you know, lots of people. She was popular, let's put it this way, and the breakfast biscuits were flying off of her tray. So we decided to ask her to come and pose for us, and she said yes. And so she came over and was being photographed, and we were focusing on her. And then after it was over, she says, she turned and said, "Ah, maman, mother." And there standing beside her was this woman dressed in this blue and red dress, and with a blue and red headband on, and holding a big pot. Well, it was her mother who was the source of the items that she was selling. And so I thought, well, wow, she's certainly a colorful character, and so let's photograph her. So I photographed her after I photographed the daughter. And she held the pot beside her, and then she put the pot on the ground. And so we got what I thought were some pretty good images. And then we said, thank you. She signed the release and picked up her pot, put it on her head, and started to walk away. And I said, "Arret, stop, stop." And she says, "Oh." And I said, I realized I had to photograph her with that pot on her head. And so that's how the image came about. It was just one of these things where you caught somebody in a natural position. And it was by all means the best photograph. Ironically, the first photograph we took of a woman who was selling chickens in Thailand, and the last photograph we took of this woman with a pot on her head, were two of the strongest photographs we got in the book. I don't know whether the beginning or the end had anything to do with it, but they certainly were among the strongest photographs.
Describe that photograph of the woman in Thailand, if you
will.
Well,
it's a simple image. She is holding a, see if I can find it here. She is holding, simply standing straight with an apron on, smiling with an Asian knot in her hair, smiling, an attractive middle-aged woman holding in her hands at chest height two plucked chickens. And they are kind of skinny, scrawny little chickens, but they were what she was offering. And she's obviously, she has a white apron on, which is now soiled with the day's work. But she's clearly the woman butcher, if you will, who's happily selling off chickens. So you will have a chicken in your pot tonight.
Right. The photographs are all in color. Why did you color? I hate to stay on this issue of money, but color is very expensive. Why did you decide to photograph in color rather than, for instance, black and white, or even a mixture of the two mediums?
It's a good question, Hal. It actually was a subject of some conflict within the team which was working on this. I started out trying the proof of concept on this by photographing the Saturday market in Chestertown, Maryland, here on the Eastern Shore. And we put people in front of the pop-up studio and tried the images and the like. We came out with some very good ones. In fact, two of those made it into the book. Two of the Chestertown photos made it into the book. But I had always assumed, serious journalism, serious documentary photography like this, I always assume should be in black and white. That's a silly prejudice, but if you think of the historical images and the important images, most of them are in black and white. And I was operating on that basis for a while, but some of the people involved in the beginning here, in the very early phases of this, including a woman who was giving me some ideas who worked at Gunston School in Centerville, said, you really should try to do this in color. So I was taking these digitally, and I took them in color, they can be converted to black and white with a few strokes of your mouse. And so I went ahead and took them, but I began to accumulate the photos in black and white. But as it increased and as I got more and more images, I realized that there was some extraordinary, there was a story told by the color. There were stories told by the color, and we needed to tell those stories. So the long and short of it was it ended up in color. The cost is not wildly greater. Digital photography, digital printing now, has made for a benefit in that you have color at a better price. But in all honesty, I think that they here have, we picked up a lot by going into color.
Oh, I would agree. I would agree with that. And the photographs in the book are actually quite beautiful. And the color is the reason for that. And I would also think that there are some cultural expressions that you capture with color that might not be captured in black and white.
That's right. I think your observation is on the money there. Certainly, like skin tones, clothes tones, the types of items that are being sold have color to them and their tone. We have a great photograph in here of a woman in that market in Senegal, which is she's showing her lettuces, and the lettuces, I just remember being stunned, and photograph was taken in late July, early August, in the middle of Africa, and her lettuces are just strikingly green and beautiful. And I could never have carried that forward had I not had this in color.
So, well, the contrast, though, with the yellow, yes, long dress that she has just makes the green jump right out
right.
The photograph as well.
That's right. Well, I in the process of all this, I learned that Senegalese women have a history of dressing, no matter what their economic status is, of dressing very colorfully. And I mean, many of you have seen West African women in the U.S. who've come to the U.S. wearing their African garments, and they have these gorgeous headdresses, which become a focal point for all of their dress. And so this woman, I think this yellow dress that you refer to that she's wearing, really did come out to be a lovely contrast to the green.
You mentioned it earlier a little bit about the kind of challenges you faced in going into the market to set up your little photographic studio to capture these images. What kind of challenges did you face trying to select the vendors that you wanted to photograph?
Well, that's again a great question. Our procedure when we began the project was to go to a market. We would put all of our stuff down and leave somebody behind to watch it. Sometimes we would set up the backdrop first. People were always curious about that. Then we would wander the market. I and the fixer, sometimes with my wife who was there, and we would look to see if there were people we thought were interesting. And I would say to the fixer, I would say, let's see if we can get her. Let's see if we can get him. Let's see if we can get that, you know, those goods. And then I would come back, can finish setting up, and the fixer, who always spoke the local language, would then see if they could get the person to come. The first person was always the hardest. People were never hostile. We didn't encounter hostility anywhere. But we did encounter reluctance because they were there by themselves and they didn't want to leave their stalls for fear that they would lose some sales. And so, but once we got one person to come, we got a lot of people to come. And indeed, in one instance, we got one person from a formal butcher shop that was sort of on a lower level of a garage-like thing. And the butcher shop had, I don't know, five or six people in there. And we got one guy out who was particularly colorful and interesting looking. And then they all wanted to be photographed. So they were lined up, you know. And since there were so many of them, somebody could watch the shop while they were gone. Anyway, so it was an interesting first phase of all of this. But the biggest problems we had were not so much cooperation, but rather just the problems of setting up the shop, finding the right place with the right light. We used only natural light here. We did not use any
light. Yeah, I was going to ask you about lighting.
Yeah, we did not use any artificial lighting. Occasionally, for a few shots, we used a reflector to try to lighten up faces and things like that. But for the most part, for the complete part, we did not use any kinds of artificial lights unless they happened somehow to be shining, which was, I can't remember any instances where we did. And sometimes we shot these, like in South Africa, we went to the market, we were doing it very early in the morning. It was winter in South Africa when we were doing it. It was July there on a different season. And so the light was very different there than it was, say, in summer in Norway, where the light goes until whenever. And so it ends up being a very interesting kind of play on light that you had to play with. And we had to do it in post-production as well. We took the images and we didn't really have to play around with them too much, but the problem was the backdrop, the so-called white backdrop, which was the same piece of fabric in each location, was in some instances brownish, in some instances bluish and the like. So the only sort of digital editing we really had to do of any note was to equalize the backdrop color in front of all of these people, because it was very different. You know, taking a photograph on the equator in Ecuador was very different than taking a photograph in Beijing, China.
Well, I've noticed, having done a little bit of photography myself, I noticed in the book the striking quality of all of the photographs, the even quality that you achieved in so many various places in the world.
Well, we were pretty lucky. I like to think it was my skill. There were some others that were not taken, which were out of focus and which had other problems. But out of each set of shots, there were a few, at least. They were in focus, tack sharp, and had good color balance and the like. So, and decent exposure. So, we did not do, you know, much editing of any images. I'm just looking through here and seeing if there were any of them. You can see some of the faces where we were lighting up with a reflector, but that was more in the beginning than it was later. And usually we just were relying upon placing the pop-up studio in a slightly shaded space that was still well enough lit so that we did not end up with too many big shadows in eyes and the like.
Well, you mentioned the fixer, and I'm sure we're not talking about a fixer like Michael Cohen or that kind of fixer. How did you find the fixer, and what was the job of the fixer?
Well, fixers are the probably the least well-known components of journalism, of all kinds of journalism. If somebody from one of the major networks goes to a place and they don't speak the local language and they don't have, you know, a full knowledge of the geography of that area, they will get a fixer. You know, the fixer rarely gets any credit. The fixer rarely, you know, is known to the person who's the news is. Although the New York Times has now begun, in some instances, including fixers' names in the materials in the stories which they write, giving them credit. Anyway, but the fixers I found always by my connections. Fortunately, I had enough connections in a lot of places. Some of it through the Foundry Photojournalism Workshop, but through other photographers I knew, or people I knew that generally. For example, I needed a fixer in South Africa. I happened to know a really wonderful guy, John Edwin Mason, who is a professor of African history and the history of photography at UVA. I contacted John. I said, I need a fixer. Can you get me one? Can you give me a name and a piece of contact information? So he said, well, tell me a little bit more. And I told him a bit more. He said, I think I've got the person for you. So I sent a message to her. She's a photographer herself, a very interesting woman, lives in the township. And sure enough, she ended up as the fixer, and she was just wonderful. I would sometimes send it out on listservs on the internet. I'd say, I need a fixer in Senegal. Or someone I knew had been with a woman who now works for the New York Times, Rukmini Kalamaki, was the former AP editor in Dakar for West Africa. And so she knew some people and knew a great guy. Unfortunately, he only spoke French. Fortunately, both my wife and I speak French, so we were able to work with him in French for the work in Senegal. So these are just critical people who are just, and there's a page for them, or couple of pages for them and some photographs in the back of the book.
So you, the fixer really embodies the local knowledge that
right.
you don't have.
And the
contacts and so forth.
Right. They're translators. Sometimes they would do, in these instances when I hadn't really been able to work in the area before, they would do advanced research into markets, which ones might have a place, which ones were the most interesting. In Ethiopia, we thought we were going to go to one market. We ended up going to another just because it was easier, but it was in a way more interesting. So the long and short of it is that these people are our eyes and ears on the ground.
Let's talk a little bit, Neil, about the markets themselves that you visited, and you mentioned the market, for instance, in Chestertown. Just for a contrast, what are these markets in the developing world, and how would they compare, as an example, with the market in Stevensville on Kent Island, and the market, which is only once a week, and the market in Chestertown, which I believe is once a week as
right.
well?
Well, you know, that's what I found interesting was that they're all fairly comparable. They are in many ways quite the same. And this was one of the reasons why we photographed the images with the white background. We wanted them all to be in a similar environment, and so that people could look at, let's say, the woman on the cover with a pot on her head and look at a woman who's holding a basket of produce in Chestertown and be able to compare just the look the nature of the stand, of the good soul, and the like. And, you know, just as in the woman in on the cover who's in Senegal, she was selling breakfast foods. There are people in the market in Chestertown who are selling croissants and other things to eat while you're in the process of moving through the market. So there are many similarities. But on the other hand, there are differences, too. In developing countries, you'll see a lot of really basic stuff like livestock. You'll see livestock sold in markets and sometimes specialty markets for livestock. We had markets in, there was a market in Colombia that we have images from, great market that sold only livestock. And we have the camel market with a woman, with a man, a Sudanese market vendor there who is standing with his rather recalcitrant camel who finally came to cooperate enough for us to get a picture of the two of them. It's a little different because a camel doesn't easily fit within a 3-meter by 3-meter frame. So we had to kind of play around with getting that one right together. And so finally we were able to get the image, but it's a great image.
Well, then to keep the camel from spitting on you would be a task as well.
There's a little story on a number of these things where I had a good little story about an image. I would put together on the facing page a little synopsis of the story. And the case of the camel, he was ready to apply a whole mouthful of phlegm on me. It was clear at one point I was ready to jump. But then he calmed down and he sat down or kneeled down on the front of the backdrop, and everybody relaxed just a minute. And so I took some images. Then he got up, and when we looked where he got up, he had left us with a present, notwithstanding the fact. So anyway.
Well, I've been to a couple of markets in Africa, and I just in terms of Chestertown, the market that I went to in Uganda, up in Jinja, is just a gigantic market. I mean, it covers acres, and the goods that are sold are both handmade and from everywhere. Is that your was that your experience?
Yes. Absolutely. We had a lot of smallish markets, you know, that were, I don't know, maybe had 30 or 40 vendors. That's still a lot of people. But we had some that were hundreds. For example, there was a market in Istanbul called the Fatih Market. A number of images in here from that market, which was outside, kept on Fridays outside of the Fatih Mosque, which is a mosque that people attend regularly. And Friday, of course, is the day of the sermons in the Muslim countries. That was, I can't begin to tell you how big it was. It was not as big as the big market in Istanbul, but it was a people's market. And it was several blocks, you know, several large urban blocks. And you could get everything you wanted there, from draperies to children's clothes, to blue jeans, to tea. You wanted a cup of tea, there was a guy coming around and selling tea to you. And so they're big. And then the goods they sold looked to me to be some handmade, some perhaps machine made, some purchased from wholesalers, but most of them being, you know, things that they had produced. And that there were fish, there were spices. I don't think there was anything you would really want that you couldn't have gotten in the Fatih market.
Well, let me mention also as a comparison, and you can add to this. I went in the grocery store in Kampala, Uganda, to basically just to see what was there. And on the shelves in this grocery store in downtown Kampala. There may be a few boxes on a couple of shelves of maybe some cereal or something, but basically the downtown grocery store was empty. And then I went to Jinja, to the market in Jinja. There was nothing that you could not buy in that market. Why isn't there, for instance, a Walmart in these places?
Well, you know, I think the answer, and I'm not an expert in this, but my layman's observation is that this is a kind of a triumph of capitalism. The individuals who collectively make up the market are able to essentially finance the acquisition of an inventory on their own, whereas it takes a much more a large amount of money to finance the acquisition of an inventory in a supermarket or a Walmart or whatever. And plus, they were able to deliver it. They are able to deliver it on a personal basis to those who shop. And so it becomes, in some ways, I think, a personal thing, whereas in the market, supermarket you refer to, you know, it's just a matter of going and getting something off the shelf. That's probably less of an enjoyment to the individuals who are buying than going to the market and seeing their favorite vendor of chickens or corn or whatever.
It may also be the fact that the sense that these are informal markets as well. You provide a place and they will come. You provide an opportunity and people will show up in order to sell whatever they've got to improve their lives, to support themselves and their families.
Well, that's absolutely right. The truth of the matter is that among a lot of the people there, there's a bigger, a much bigger entrepreneurial spirit than you encounter in a lot of places. And that's one of the reasons why so many immigrants in the U.S. come and set up businesses when they come here. I think it's a spirit and something they're used to exercising in their world. But if you look at it brings to mind essentially one of the reviewers of the book has said that it catches the soul of the global marketplace, the book. And the two elements they mention are entrepreneurial pride and the joy of human connection. I think they're both essential elements to make a market work. And that, you know, the human connection part, I think, would be very different for the person shopping in the Kampala supermarket than in the Kampala marketplace.
Well, you mentioned immigrants. What is there a role? Did you find a role for immigrants in the markets that you photographed in?
Yes. It was interesting. We encountered immigrants in several areas, not unlike the U.S. They're immigrants who sell in markets where they feel secure enough to do so in the U.S. But we encountered a great picture. I love the guy who in South Africa, who there was a fellow who was a refugee from Zimbabwe, and he was in the marketplace selling flush toilets and associated plumbing activities. Well, he'd apparently had an experience in Zimbabwe in the construction world, but he, when he came to South Africa, he said, I can take that knowledge and maybe sell it. So he was actually, I mean, he had an inventory of water closets, toilets, drains, traps, and all of this. And he would explain to people how you could install one. So the long and short of it, it was that he was taking his immigrant status and applying it to and his knowledge from his original country and applying it in his new nation. And he seemed to be actually doing pretty well.
Did you get any sense, Neil, in terms of how these markets are managed? How are they organized?
All over the place. We found some markets that are actually, they had vendors operating in a private situation. In other words, a real estate, I'll say developer, or someone who is a real estate investor had created a more sophisticated market, and they would actually manage it as licensing a certain vendor to set up in a particular place. Other places, they appeared to be more like cooperatives, where the people who were there owned the space, and others, they appeared to be municipally developed, either for management or just for the space. For example, in Istanbul, there was a market that was the only market that I know of that I was told that existed that sold only organic materials, and it was set up in a municipal parking garage, not unlike the garages we see here. And they apparently had just gotten approval from the local town area to set up, and it was rocking and rolling there. They were selling a lot of stuff.
Neil, we're almost out of time, but I did want to ask you one more quick question. How did you find the role of women in the markets you visited?
Well, that's very interesting. The markets, even in Muslim countries, women seem to have an active role, in part because I think Muslim women do much of the shopping. They may be accompanied by males, but they do much of the shopping. So having women in the markets was important, but it went beyond that. For example, we got there's a great photograph in the last one in the book of a woman who is the manager in Quito. And you can catch her. She was elected by her members, and she can catch, you can catch her spirit in that photo.
Neil, your book is beautiful, and I want to thank you for showing us this fascinating picture of markets around the world. You remind us of how important they are, and as I said at the beginning of the program, they offer a place to meet, a place to buy, a place to sell, and a chance to work and to exhibit this entrepreneurial spirit from around the world. They offer opportunity, and the opportunity is to share in the economic life of the community. Where can people get your book? I assume at Amazon, but
yeah.
Where
it's
else?
Available on Amazon, but you can get it from your local independent dealer. Book dealer, bookseller. They can get it from their usual suppliers, Ingram and the like. And, you can also go to, the book has a very brief website called market-thebook.com. That's market-thebook.com. And you can actually order it through the distributor there.
Neil, thank you very much being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Hal.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.